Hare Krishna. So we're reading from Krishna Sangati, the 12th story. This is the full version we read this morning, a very, very small version. Jai Srimati Radharani ki jai, Sri Radhasthani ki jai. One day, as the residents of Vrindavan were preparing for the Diwali festival,
I came to know that Sri Radhika and her sakis were making pearl ornaments. At once, I went to the northwest corner of Radhakund. Seated in the courtyard of a Madhavi grove beside Malya Hari Kund, I found Radha and her friends. The sight of that assembly of beautiful gopis gave me total satisfaction. Radhika sat upon a soft cloth, holding pearls in her lap, as she busied herself stringing a delicate necklace, for whom I did not know. Around her sat Lalita, Vishakha, and other sakis. Maidservants moved here and there, carrying pearls from one saki to another, as best suited their project. This is Krishna is observing something and he's speaking. This is, enchanted by the gopis' exquisite movements, I watched them for some time. They stole glances at me from the corners of their eyes, but those haughty girls made no effort to acknowledge my presence. In fact, they purposefully ignored me. I cleared my throat, stepped into the courtyard, and addressed Sri Radha with all the humility I could muster. "Dear Sakhi," I said, "like you, I have a great desire to celebrate this festival. I would like to participate by decorating my two cows, Hamsi and Harini. My humble request is that you spare a few of your pearls for this noble purpose and thus earn a reputation as the most magnanimous amongst the beautiful gopis of Braja." When Radha heard my request, she barely responded. She gave me nothing more than an indifferent glance. The gopis continued about their business, discreetly exhibiting the priceless gems in their laps and on the lac-stained ground. I felt neglected, and I accused the gopis, "Friends, has your adolescent beauty gone to your head? Have you become so proud that you cannot even hear the plea of a humble mendicant? Please listen to me for a moment." But the gopis were not about to listen. Instead, at Radha's instigation, they began to laugh, their laughter being as melodious as the sound of the Yamuna's lapping waves. Finally, Lalita Devi accosted me in her usual aggressive way. She blurted out, "Oh hero, how is it that these pearls, fit for queens and kings, are now earmarked for your cows? I know, perhaps we should give them all to you. In this way, you can decorate your entire herd." I understood the gopis' playful mood and replied to them in kind, "Lalita, I do not require all your pearls. Just give me a few so that I can decorate the four horns of my two favorite cows. That's all." As her friends watched from the corner of their lovely eyes, partially covered by their saris, but still more beautiful than blue lotuses, Lalita gathered her pearls together and displayed them as she jokingly said, "Hari, what can I do? I do not see even one pearl good enough for your cows." At this, I lost my temper and hastily replied, "Clever girl, forget it, just forget it. But after this, never again call me a miser." I cannot remember the many ways I reprimanded the gopis, but needless to say, being spurned by them, I had no recourse other than to take revenge, and a just revenge at that. Returning to Nandagrama, I took shelter of my mother and pleaded, "Mother, please at once give me some pearls. I want to sow them in the field and grow pearl plants. We shall gain immense wealth, and I can then decorate my cows commensurately." I repeated my request many times, but mother only raised her eyebrows and smiled. With a laugh, she said, "My darlings, pearls do not sprout. Why not try sowing some other seeds? You can turn a profit with so many crops." But I insisted, "Mother, you must give me some pearls. I guarantee that my pearls will sprout in 3 days. You will see for yourself. Please believe me." Mother feigned surprise as she pretended to accept my request, but she could not actually refuse. Placing her pearls in a silken cloth and shaking her head, she gently sent me on my way. Full of enthusiasm, I hurried to the Yamuna, and near the Jalaharana Ghata, I began to till a very fertile field. As I was seeding the soil beds, some gopis passed by and made their presence known by cutting derisive jokes and laughing. I completely ignored them, however, and after covering the pearls with some fresh earth, I erected around my field a protective fence of thorn bushes. By planting my mother's best pearls, I sowed the seeds of creepers that would quickly fructify into juicy fruits of the gopis' humiliation. I had devised a plan by which to embarrass them and gain the upper hand. I would make the gopis beg me for pearls, and in the process teach them how a person feels when rejected. That day, I sent some of my friends to beg from the gopis milk for watering my pearl plants. True to form, they laughed and said, "Our milk is not suitable for such a noble purpose. Better Krishna uses the milk of the cows for which he's going growing the pearls. And if that milk is insufficient," they added, "he can collect milk from the cacti in the desert." My friends felt ridiculed, but I remained undaunted. So that the gopis could see what I was doing, I made a great commotion as I watered my plants. And on the fourth day of my enterprise, the pearls began to sprout. Delighted, I ran to tell my mother, and holding onto her sari, I brought her to see the sprouts. Unable to explain what she was seeing, she could only exclaim, "What is this? What is this?" Uneasy, she simply returned home. But when the gopis heard the news, they laughed amongst themselves and said, "These are either thorn bushes or creepers of Krishna's envy." But I knew that they were actually pearl sprouts. The creepers that grew from these sprouts looked like hemp plants, tall and coarse. Yet within a few days they blossomed with large violet flowers. Those flowers created a heavenly scent that spread throughout Vraja, driving the bees mad and giving the Vrajavasis inexplicable joy. Then, lo and behold, in a few days, pearls began to appear upon the creepers. The uncommon beauty of the pearls excelled those that I had planted. Crowds of amazed Vrajavasis arrived to wonder at their splendor. And of course, the young gopis, dumbfounded and driven by greed, came daily to see the ever-unfolding opulence of my pearls. One day, the gopis held an emergency meeting to discuss recent events. "Friends," said one gopi, "you must all know that by now Nanda's son has miraculously grown pearls by Yamuna's shore. The quality of those pearls puts the best of ours to shame, and after we treated him the way we did, we cannot expect him to share them with us. Just the opposite, we can only expect him to ridicule our ornaments." The gopis spoke excitedly amongst themselves. "Why should we fear?" argued one. "We have watched Krishna grow these pearls. Can we not plant our own field and benefit just as much as he did?" Jai, Shri Radha Kalachanji ki jai. "And our field will be twice as large as his," added another. "Our pearls twice as beautiful," declared the third. This strategy met with a round of applause from all except sober Lalita. Lalita interrupted the gloating gopis and said, "Sakhis, have you all gone mad? Miracles like lifting Govardhan Hill and growing pearls are impossible for even demigods. Only Krishna, who has been invested with some Siddha mantra, can effortlessly accomplish such feats." Lalita warned the gopis, "Do any of you have such a mantra? Have you ever performed such miracles? If not, then you had better forget the idea right now. Otherwise, I predict that all of you will tumble into a bottomless pit of embarrassment and ridicule. Lalita's words momentarily silenced the gopis, with the exception of Tungavidya, who unconvinced spoke up. Krishna received his mantra from somewhere, she argued. We can get such a mantra from Nandimukhi, and thus we can also grow pearls. After some debate, the gopis accepted Tungavidya's counsel. Like a flock of ducklings on water, they sought out Nandimukhi and humbly submitted their intentions to her. Nandimukhi was wise and could immediately see through my plan. Yet she did not disclose it to the gopis. Greedy to participate in a new pastime, she played along and said, Sakhis, Krishna did not produce these pearls by the power of some mantra. Perplexed, the gopis looked at one another as Nandimukhi went on. This wonder was made possible by the mystic potency of Vrindavan's soil. Now the gopis were skeptical. But Nandimukhi continued to support her assertion. The soil of Vrindavan is transcendental. It produces so many kinds of precious and semi-precious jewels. I know this to be true from the teachings of the noble Purnamashi, and you have all seen it for yourselves. Are they not, among other ornate wonders, golden trees with coral twigs, emerald leaves, diamond buds, and ruby fruits growing in this land? Of course there are. Then why make such a commotion about a few cultivated pearls? The pearls Krishna planted grow by the influence of the soil. If you plant pearls and if you water them abundantly with milk and water, your pearls will be superior to Krishna's. The gopis believed Nandimukhi's every word. Intoxicated with confidence that they could undo me, they embraced her and turned to their homes in bliss. That very day, the gopis engaged their servants in preparing fields larger than Krishna's for their enterprise. The following morning, they personally planted all of the best pearls from their homes. Then, morning, noon, and evening, the gopis carefully began watering their pearl fields with milk, butter, and ghee, anxious to see the first sign of pearl sprouts. Chandravali soon came to know of the efforts of her rivals. Not to be outdone, she convinced her friends to empty their homes of every single pearl and to prepare fields even more extensive than those of their rivals. She is going even more in that direction. Sure enough, amidst great expectations, in a few days, all the pearl fields of the gopis began to yield small sprouts. Upon seeing the tender shoots of their conspiracy, the gopis became proud. They ridiculed my soft-hearted friends. Meanwhile, the cowherd men noticed that their store of pearls had disappeared. They took all the pearls from their homes. They also noticed a shortage of milk in their homes. Seeing their wives absent, the gopas inquired from their mothers in an angry mood, Ma, what have our wives done with our pearls and milk? The elder gopis replied, Son, do not chastise these girls. Sri Krishna has successfully grown a host of pearls from a few pearl seeds. These girls have followed his example, and they are now watering their pearl sprouts with your milk. But do not worry. Very soon you will realize a large profit from this investment, and your wealth will grow proportionately. The simple-hearted cowherd men, satisfied with this answer, went about their work, anticipating newfound wealth. One day, Vishakha Devi, after carefully studying the gopis' pearl sprouts, whispered to some of her friends, Gopikas, the young plants in our fields appeared to be different than Krishna's. This is the surprise now. This rumor quickly spread among the gopis, and very soon Srimati Radharani secretly pronounced that their plants were nothing but thorn creepers. Such news, of course, could not have kept secret for so long. Soon the news spread throughout Braja. The gopis' fields produced nothing but thorn bushes. When this news came to me, I sent some of my friends to congratulate the gopis for their prosperous harvest. But they stubbornly denied having taken up such an occupation lower than cow protection. Unlike some people, came their message, we gopis would never adopt agriculture for our livelihood. What to speak of planting our family wealth for princely gain? After the gopis had thoroughly insulted my friends, it was clear to me that I had no alternative but to proceed with my plan. To pour salt into the gopis' wounds, I began to decorate with garlands of pearls all my friends, cows, calves, sheep, lambs, she-buffaloes, female goats, and their kids, as well as the monkeys that frolic throughout Vrindavan. He's got so many pearls. Without their own ornaments, when the gopis saw my display of opulence, they were ashamed. Fearful of their husband's anger, they quickly held a meeting, and suspecting Nandamukhi of being a conspirator, concluded that she was partial towards me. Now they're blaming Nandamukhi. In a huff, the gopis returned to Nandamukhi, and after describing the events of the previous week, rebuked her to no end. But Nandamukhi was not intimidated. With her best Brahminical manners, she reasoned with the gopis, "Hey, Sakis, on the strength of all my austerities, I assure you that I have never defeated you, I have never deceived you." "Oh no, never. You are equanimity personified," mocked one of the gopis. "And after your being Krishna's cousin, and your being Krishna's cousin had nothing to do with giving us bad advice, right?" Unruffled, Nandi continued, "Don't blame me. It was you who spoiled everything and caused your own undoing." The gopis became even more irate. They shot back, "That's right, it was our fault. And it was we who listened to you and spoiled our family fortunes." Nandi explained, "By the promise of newfound wealth, you all became proud. Overconfident, you went about your business like a noisy spinning wheel, making a rat-a-tat-tat noise. Of course, Krishna and his friends were fully aware of your every move. And on top of that, like naive girls, you left your fields unguarded." She's so smart. The gopis were sobered. "And what about our unguarded fields?" they asked. "Conceited girls," called Nandamukhi, "I will explain the truth of these matters. Expert Krishna bribed his Brahmin friend Madhu Mangala with bowls of sweet rice and enticed him to uproot your newly sprouting pearl plants and replace them with thorn bushes. He then took your pearl plants, planted some in his garden, and discarded the rest in the Yamuna." At first, the gopis were incredulous. They said, "Krishna wouldn't have done that. I don't believe it. And impossible, impossible." Again, they charged Nandamukhi, saying, "O female ascetic of Kali Yuga, since you know so much, you must be an accomplice of that fat-bellied Brahmana." He's talking about Madhu Mangala. But at last, convinced by her many arguments and by the air of innocence she projected, the gopis accepted Nandamukhi's story. "We can't believe what a rascal he is," they exclaimed. "This time he's gone too far." But at last, disheartened, the gopis gazed at one another, offered pranams to Nandi, and returned to their meeting place to discuss this new information. They're back to their board meeting. After an embarrassing silence, Radhika spoke up. "Friends, whether Nandamukhi tricked us or Krishna robbed us, our plight is the same. We have no pearls, and we stand to be severely reprimanded by our superiors. Pearls are not easily acquired in Vrindavan, and therefore I suggest we consider how to obtain some of Krishna's pearls at whatever price he may charge." The gopis deliberated on Radhika's proposal, arguing its pros and cons. Finally, they agreed to send Chandramukhi and Kanchanalata to purchase some of my pearls. Thus, a little before dawn, on the very next day, just as I arrived at my pearl fields to water them, Chandramukhi and Kanchanalata appeared carrying a large quantity of gold. Subala and I were seated in the garden house cracking jokes about the gopis. Awkward situation. To avoid appealing to me, whom they had earlier rebuked, the gopis addressed Subala. "Dear Sakha, having heard that you are selling your surplus pearls, we have come to purchase a selection of your best ones. And to pay the price, we have brought along the purest quality gold." When I heard the gopis' appeal, I silenced Subala with a touch of my hand and replied, "But are you not the same gopis who only a few days ago denied my request for just a few pearls? What to speak of a few pails of milk for my pearl crop?" As the two girls cast awkward glances at each other, I added, "I would rather throw all my pearls into the Kalindi than give you even one. And if you want to buy my pearls, well, my answer is that all the wealth in your homes, including the houses themselves, cannot purchase the least of my pearls." Kanchanalata stamped her feet and snapped back, "Why do we have to tolerate these cruel words?" She then appealed to Subala, saying, "Were we not in fear of our husbands, we would never stoop to such a humiliating act. And although many jewels are available in Mathura, we have no time to make the trip. O Subala, please be our middleman. We are prepared to pay even more than the going rate for these pearls." "More than the going rate?" Those were just the words I was waiting to hear. The gopis were desperate, and in Radhika's own words, they were willing to pay whatever price he may charge. "Well, well, well," I began. "That is a different story. I am, after all, very soft-hearted, not miserly like you girls. But if I decide to sell you my excess pearls, who will determine the price?" "We will," the two girls replied in unison. "Well then," I said, "let's hear your proposal." Kanchanalata and Chandramukhi exchanged sly glances, and the former said, "Friend Subala, please take responsibility for mediating this contract. If you do so judiciously, your good name will be spread throughout the land." Subala looked at me and said, "Friend, your duty as owner of this product is to clearly state the asking price. That will avoid unnecessary bantering." I shook my head and considered the merits of Subala's words. After closely examining Kanchanalata, I replied, "Sakha, I can understand Radha's intentions. Imagining Kanchanalata to be priceless, Radha has asked Chandramukhi to bring her to me. But my pearls are worth more than a heap of Kanchana. With all her exquisite charms, Kanchanalata is hardly a fair price for even one of my pearls." Kanchanalata's eyebrows knitted into a scowl. She fumed. "Chandramukhi, don't be a fool. I told you we should stay away from this hurry. Did you bring me here to be harassed by him? I am having no more of this. You can bring the pearls because I am leaving right now." When I saw the two girls arguing, I turned to Subala and said, "Friend, I told you that they could never fix a proper price." Subala then rose from the seat we were sharing and approached the girls in a conciliatory mood. "Chandramukhi," he said, "my friend is eager to sell his pearls. If your dearest friends, Radha, Lalita, and others come to negotiate a fair price, I see no reason why they cannot purchase the pearls they desire. In fact, I will assist as a mediator. Have no fear." Still boiling with anger, the girls accepted Subala's advice and hurried back to Radha with his invitation. Radha and his sakis carefully weighed every possible course of action, and having no other recourse, they returned en masse to expedite the purchase of my pearls. The exchange that took place after Radha and her friends returned to barter with Krishna was full of humor, innuendo, and supreme love. It was a contest of wits, a debate for supremacy, in which neither side lost. Rather, both sides tasted the greatest transcendental bliss. Krishna continued, "I was watering my plants when the gopis arrived, and after an initial meeting with Subal, Radhika, eager to hear the proceedings, hid in a nearby Kadamba Kunja. Just then, I returned from the field. Unable to see Radha amongst the gopis, I asked, "Where is Sri Radha?" Tungavidya replied, "Affectionate Jatila kept her home today to do household chores." This mother-in-law. I knew that Jatila was as affectionate as the gopis were truthful. Krishna is saying, I knew that Jatila was as affectionate as the gopis were truthful. And so I was skeptical. Looking around for a sign, I saw Madhu making secret gestures to inform me that Radhika was nearby hiding. This is Madhu Mangal giving it away. Throughout the entire exchange that followed, Radha would communicate to me and implement her desires in different ways. At times through letters, at times through her sakis, and rarely when she was very angry and I was very fortunate, she would speak in her own gentle voice. Heaving and puffing, Subal and I dragged the treasure chest from the garden cottage. And to prepare the gopis for what was to come, we made a grand comedy out of displaying my pearl fruit. I purposely spilled a goodly part of the contents of the chest on the ground, and laughing in glee like a miser, I poured handful after handful of the most exquisite pearls into my lap. The gopis' faces were full of scorn as they glanced at one another, silently waiting for the drama to end. And when it did, the blissful barter for pearls began in earnest. I could have easily gifted the gopis with what they wanted, but since I had adopted the dharma of a merchant, it was my duty to demand a fair price for my goods. Thus, when soft-hearted Subal advised me to advance the pearls and collect the payment later, I declined. After all, Smriti Sastra advises that in the matter of finance and eating, one should abandon all shyness. Adhering to scriptural injunctions, I maintain my determination, even in the face of repeated threats by the gopis to leave out of frustration and false pride. Fortunately, every time the gopis tried to go, Subala enticed them to return. Thus, our humorous and loving negotiations brought bliss to all involved. At the outset of our exchange, Nandimukhi arrived and read a message from the noble Purnamashi. The revered guru of Braja said, "O Hari, as the son of Braja's sovereign, you are the master of vast wealth. Since these young girls are most devoted to you, do not be too persistent. Accept whatever they're able to pay and send them back home happy." I was pleased to accept just payment from every gopi, but my father's treasury contained unlimited wealth. Of what use to me was more gold? I was always interested in only the most valuable currency. I am always interested in only the most valuable currency, the gopis' love. Therefore, in that assembly of sakis and sakas, and to the gopis' mortification, I asked each one to remunerate me with their own loving skills. Exhibiting the strength of my biceps, I asked Lalita to engage me in a wrestling match. If she could pin me down just once, then I would most happily bestow upon her the pearls she desired. Tossing my dice upon the ground, I challenged Sudevi to a game of chance. If I were to win, then I could take liberties with her. And if I were to lose, then she could do the same with me. Following that, I offered to become, by my mystic powers, a garland of sapphires about Champakalata's neck. By allowing me the briefest interlude at that sacred place, she could purchase from me the pearls of her choice. She would just let him become the necklace around her neck. But the gopis were not to be easily outdone. Expert in loving arguments, with gusto, they returned my salvos with humor. And after my very generous proposal to Champakalata, the gopis countered, accusing me of mystic impotence. an inability to fulfill my claims. Such an impertinent allegation incensed both me and my Sakas. Madhu came to the rescue saying, if Hari has lost his mystic powers, then how did he grow the pearls from the ground? Lalita laughed. It was due to the potency of the soil of Vrindavan and the effect of associating with young girls, whispered Radhika. Vishakha, whose heart was fully in tune with Radha's, then repeated Radha's words aloud in a cuckoo's soft voice. I then replied, if the soil of Vrindavan is the source of these pearls, then why did your pearls turn into thorny bushes? Lalita counted, on account of some defect in our soil or seeds. The gopis laughed to hear Lalita, who prodded Vishakha, saying, dear Vishakha, Devi Vishakha, you say that Krishna's misbehavior is the cause of this bumper crop, not his mystic power. What do you mean? This is a serious charge against our all good friend. Please explain. Vishakha replied, everyone knows about Krishna's youthful exploits with the girls of Braja. His debauchery speaks for itself. So, what more need we say about that? Sakis, even we village girls know that thoughtless involvement with the fallen can degrade even the greatest of yogis. Is it so surprising then that by contact with Krishna, as thoroughly addicted to women as he is, his pearls became ensnared in samsara and became pregnant in the womb of the earth, producing offspring in the form of pearl sprouts? Is it? Need I say more? The gopis were so amused by Vishakha's homily that she could barely finish her sentence. They laughed at her wit, and even more so at my sour face. Lalita then added, Hari, if you indeed possess mystic powers, then why don't you produce pearls in a way that does not degrade you to the status of a cultivator? Satyabhama, I must admit that for a few moments I was speechless. Through Radha's ingenuity, the gopis had temporarily defeated me and gained the upper hand, but I quickly regained the advantage by picking up palmful after palmful of pearls and allowing them to slip through my fingers. In that way, I reminded the gopis of their handicap. The pearls are still in his hands. While the gopis were mulling over the next strategy, I turned to Tungavidya and offered her my pearls. My voice quivered with true emotion as I said, my only desire is to serve the lotus feet of Sri Radha. Her fragrance is the sweetest, her beauty unlimited, her nature incomparably soft. However, because she does not love me, she has hidden in some distant place. Therefore, only Tungavidya can help me. She knows all the arts and sciences. If she were to accept me as her disciple, take me to a secluded place, purify me with rituals, and teach me the necessary sadhana by which I can please Radha, then I could obtain for her the sacred mantra to achieve Sri Radha. Overjoyed, I would fall at Tungavidya's feet, the feet of my Guru Deva, and would offer her the dakshina of an unlimited quantity of pearls. Hearing my humble offer, the gopis giggled as they looked at Tungavidya. Though ecstatic within, Tungavidya knit her eyebrows and cast a furious glance at me. Turning to Nandamukhi, she cried out, "Oh, Nandamukhi, you are a perfect renunciant. Why don't you initiate your cousin in this process?" Tungavidya turned on her heels and was preparing to leave when Vishakha caught hold of her hand and said, "Sakhi, do not be offended. Krishna is not qualified for initiation. Therefore, neither you nor Nandi need accept him." Nandamukhi replied, "Preposterous! How can you slander the son of Nanda, the best friend of religion? How could he, the goal of all initiates, not be qualified for initiation himself?" But Vishakha did not back down. "I tell the truth and caution you," she said. "He is not qualified to be a disciple." Nandamukhi cast a glance at me and asked, "What's the problem, Vishakha? Don't make allegations you can't support with evidence." Vishakha slowly shook her head and said, coyly, I have evidence and I will present it. This wanton boy, she said, pointing her delicate forefinger at me, ate the remnants of a ghostly associate of the demigoddess Gauri Devi. Thus he has transgressed all regulative principles and is ineligible to be a disciple. Vishakha's indictment caused a rowdy dispute amongst the gopas and gopis. Finally, she produced written statements made by two witnesses, Malili and Bringi, to prove beyond a shadow of doubt that some days ago I had taken the remnants left by a ghost. Since the Aborigine girl's evidence was strong, I had to admit the facts. Some time back, I was tending cows by Govardhan Hill when a few cows strayed into Gauratirtha. While searching for the strays, a highly perfumed attendant of Gauri Devi accosted me. This ghost, masquerading as a gopi, came out of the temple, kidnapped me, and in a nearby grove, forced the remnants of her chewed tambula between my trembling lips. Because I was in a state of shock, I do not remember what happened after that. Of course, he ate it. Under further interrogation from Lalita, I was forced to admit to another transgression. This one took place a few days after the first. While I was bringing flowers for Gandharvika Radha, the same ghostly being again forcibly kissed me and placed the nectar of her lips upon my mouth. What could I do? I was an innocent victim of circumstance. The self-appointed jury of gopis immediately pronounced their verdict. Krishna's caste has been compromised by his engaging in sinful acts, and thus he is qualified neither as a disciple nor as a trader in Braja. Now he can't even be trader in Braja. No more merchant. The clever gopis were trying to turn the tables on me. Not only were they trying to revoke my trader's license, but also, led by Lalita, they were arguing how I could best atone for my sins. Now they're ready to give the punishment. Some suggested that I counteract the contamination by again submitting to the contaminant. What a ghastly thought. Others argued that as a property owner, I should pay a fine. Still others argued that the fine be doubled because I was a prince. And yet others, whose minds bent in ways of the tantrics, prescribed the nectar from the lips of the Aborigine girls Bringi and Malili as the proper antidote. To settle this free-for-all, a letter arrived from Radhika, whose handwriting is like strings of pearls. Citing tantric atonements from the Ujjavala Sanghita, Radhika said, "If Krishna is truly repentant and willing to atone for his misdeeds, then with his lotus feet he should tread upon a flowering creeper taken from an Ashoka tree. Then, with the nectar squeezed from these flowers, he should wash his own lotus face. Finally, a qualified priest should administer Panchamrita to his camphor-scented lips. In this way, the sins of this tender child can be quickly driven away." It's written in a way you've got to really get close to write. See, read what's written. Needless to say, my friends and I, what to speak of the host of gopis, were in complete agreement with Radhika's judgment. Thus absolved of my sins, I proposed further payment schemes for my pearls to Chitra, Induleka, Rangadevi and others. Of course, the payment scheme for each gopi was different. Unique, loving pastime. When I beheld mysterious Ananga Manjari, the little sister of Sri Radha, I said, "The bumblebee of my mind is so delighted with the sweetness of Ananga Manjari that I am prepared to give her my roundest and heaviest pearls free of charge." Wow. Ananga Manjari raised her eyebrows in anticipation of my next sentence. "I won't charge her anything," I said. "However, out of affection, I will take her to a kunja and worship her youthful beauty. I shall perform Anga Nyasa by installing the 50 syllables of Cupid's mantra upon her body, beginning with her heart. Then I shall bestow upon her a perfect mantra, a hymn by which she can enjoy the company of Cupid himself. Thereafter, my new disciple, being completely satisfied, with no doubt bestow upon will no doubt bestow upon me the jewels of her coquetry. How do you spell, how do you pronounce this? Coquetry? Coquetry as dakshina. In turn, I, being delighted with her, shall bestow upon her the title Vilashacharya, the exemplar of pleasure pastimes. All the gopis laughed at Anangamanjari's embarrassment as she retreated behind Tulsi and Rupa and peeped over their shoulders at me. Just then, Malili and Bringi appeared with two letters from Lalita. Everyone gathered around as Lalita handed one letter to Subala and kept the second. Subala carefully read this letter, rolling his eyes and making sounds of disbelief. At my prodding, he read the letter aloud, which disclosed an extraordinary turn of events. Postmarked, Javat Grama, the letter said, Dear Subala, I composed this letter with syllables that are nothing less than the condensed nectar of my love. Still, one matter needs further attention. Our elders are angry with us and constantly complain because we squandered the family pearls. In such a stressful situation, I am obliged to point out that your friend has taken up pearl farming on a plot under my dominion. As the sovereign of this land, I must request that he promptly pay the taxes for the use of such land. With this revenue, we shall purchase pearls from Mathura to restore our family's loss. If he is unable to pay the required sum for the use of such unique land, then five of you should meet and offer, and after settling the rate, a commensurate number of pearls should be handed over to Lalita. Upon hearing Radha's message, I snatched the letter from Subal. My hands shook and my eyes opened wide as I read it. It was unbelievable. Waving the letter with one hand and slapping my thigh with the other, I laughed and replied, How astonishing! Can it be true? These sly foxes have pulled a rabbit out of the hat. As if picking flowers from the sky, they have introduced a new issue. Incredible, simply incredible. Madhu Mangal spoke up, Friend, spoiled Lalita has fabricated this lie and influenced innocent Radha. As long as she and her charlatan friends remain in Braja, we shall have no peace. Run them out of Vrindavan immediately. Taking my cue from Madhu, I stepped up to Lalita and, shaking the letter in my hand, said, Lalita, how has my Vrindavan become your Sakhi's property? Who was authorized to make such a transfer? And how, when, and where did such a transfer of ownership take place? Unaffected by my challenge, Lalita answered, Hari, why are you so surprised? You too are present at the coronation festival of Shrimati Radhika. Have you now conveniently forgotten that memorable event? Vishakha added, Lalita, why be surprised at Krishna's loss of memory? He transgressed religious principles, and thus darkness clouds his mind. That is why he is black. And by contact with him, these boys have also become confused. As Vishakha was speaking, Vrindadevi arrived. After all the gopis had affectionately embraced her and had briefed her of the situation, Vrindadevi asked Lalita to describe, for my benefit, the wonderful coronation ceremony of Sri Radha. Glowing in ecstasy, Lalita Devi then joyfully described in detail how, by the order of Lord Brahma in Gopeshwara Mahadev, Radhika was crowned queen of Vrindavan. Like the wind, Lalita narrated the events one after the other. The wives of the demigods, headed by Brahma's wife, Savitri, had showered flowers upon Braja. Bhagavati Purnamashi had performed Radha's coronation bath upon a ruby-encrusted altar. Lalita herself, assisted by Radha's maidservants, had anointed, bathed, dried, dressed, ornamented, garlanded, and worshipped her with all paraphernalia. All those assembled had gifted her with divine and earthly presence. Finally, Purnamashi had crowned Radha and proclaimed her Queen of Vrindavan. Throughout Lalita's description, though I was experiencing unlimited bliss within, I continued to shake my head in disbelief. When she finally concluded, I answered matter-of-factly, how is it that I have never seen nor heard of such a coronation? How is it that such a great festival upon the lands belonging to my father went unnoticed by me and my countless friends? Glancing at each gopi one by one, I continued, if you want me to accept that Radha was bathed and anointed Queen of Vrindavan, then you might as well accept that I was also appointed Braja's king. While Subhal chuckled and Madhu beat his armpits, the gopis checked their laughter. But I had not anticipated that clever Tungabhidya, who would have an elaborate answer to my challenge. Biting her bottom lip to hold back her laughter, she exclaimed, indeed, indeed, Hari, who has not heard of your wonderful Abhishek ceremony? Truly, it is the talk of the universe. Like an actress on the stage, Tungabhidya parodied my coronation, enacting the event with movements of her hands, eyes, and limbs. Just behold our king, she began, wearing a crooked crown fashioned from the sky flowers of his daydreams. He is comfortably seated on a throne made from the golden mud of Pavana Sarovar, upholstered with the moss growing on the banks of the Yamuna, encrusted with nuts, berries, and pebbles. Held by Subhal, an elegant royal umbrella made from shells of tortoises and exuding a shower of the most fragrant nectar shades the king's head. Courtiers like Ujjavala and Chatura stand on his sides and fan the king with chamaras made from the soft hairs from the palms of people's hands. Officiating at this ceremony are the greatest sages born from the wombs of the most celebrated of barren women. They perform his abhishek with the milk of bulls. And when their effort is complete, they declare him Braja's king. To show his unlimited prowess, our king holds in his right hand a banana scepter. In his left hand, a hair horn bow. And upon his shoulders, arrows made of flowers. Thus the king of Vrindavan shines forth like another Kubera. I tapped my feet on the ground as Tungabhidya completed her monologue. In this and so many other ways, his cowherd friends performed Krishna's splendorous abhishek. Now that his fame has been carried throughout the universities, Tungabhidya, why, O Gopikas, are none of you falling at his feet and addressing him as Mahadeva incarnate? The gopis laughed with delight and clapped their hands, all the while stealing glances at me from the corners of their eyes. And to add insult to injury, Chitra then rejoined, Vishakha, Tungabhidya, why joke about Krishna? He truly is Mahadev, the Lord of Lords, the auspicious Supreme Being. Can there be any doubt about it? Tungabhidya asked, Chitra, if that is so, why is he not in heaven? Why does he live on earth with us ordinary folk? Chitra replied, we all know how easily Krishna is enamored by the members of the opposite sex. This habit so enraged his wife Gauri that she kicked him out of heaven. With no place to call home, Krishna has come to our forest and accepted the dress of a cowherd. By performing Purushacharana, he has gained the favor of the queen Radhika. Thus, he happily passes his time amongst us. Do not ridicule him, but welcome him, as you should a guest. All the gopis turned towards me, and following Chitra's lead, offered pranamas. As a true friend, Madhu Mangal was outraged by the charges Chitra and Tungabhidya levied against me. He turned on Brinda, saying, O keeper of the forests, have you abandoned your groves just to eat salted rice and buttermilk, to become a servant in the houses of these gopis? But Brinda was not about to be intimidated. You semblance of a Brahmin, she snapped. Rude, coarse, envious jester that you are. Why did you insist on creating such a disturbance? Just as a duel was about to begin between Madhu and Brinda, Malili and Bringi interjected. Lalita, have you forgotten the contents of our queen's second letter? Lalita smiled innocently and asked, what was that? Malili and Mringa replied, Radhika wrote that whoever behaves in a contrary fashion, making fallacious arguments, whoever instigates quarrel and hostility in the matter of settling a just, equitable price for these pearls, those people should immediately bound and sent to her for punishment. Lalita winked at Vishakha and said, this Madhumangal is definitely inflaming the situation. Shouldn't we immediately tie him with some vines and creepers? As soon as Madhu heard this threat, he said, Sakha, I have some very important work to do. I will return as soon as I finished. So he takes off. I lovingly restrained Madhu and addressed Subal with feigned malice. Sakha, did you see how these clever girls, using the trick of a witty charade, undermine my authority in Vrindavan? Subal replied, not only did I see it, but I also heard how they dismissed your proprietary rights over Braja and made you into a common farmer by depending that you pay a land tax. It seemed that the ownership of Vrindavan had re-emerged as a hot issue. Was I the proprietor, or did Radhika own the land? To resolve this debate, Brindadevi urged both parties to refer to Shastra. Lalita Devi was not in favor of a scriptural debate. She considered that the direct evidence of Radha's coronation by Purnamashi and the wives of the demigods were conclusive. Yet, Subala was against accepting as evidence a coronation to which I was not a witness. Lalita Devi then gave what she considered to be additional perceivable evidence. She tried to show by analogy that the forest of Vrindavan was a manifestation of Radhika's own form and thus her domain. Lalita gave many, many examples. Among them were the jasmine creepers and the champaka flowers, which have the same form as Radha. The lissom movements of the deer, which resemble the fluttering of her eyes. The swaying bimba fruit, which resemble her lustrous lips. The beaks of parrots, which resembled her raised nose, and the tailed feathers of the peacocks, which resemble her decorated braid. Hearing these examples transported me into bliss. Yet for the sake of argument, I rejected Lalita's evidence. The similarity between Radha and Vrindavan is imaginary. I said, how can that constitute real evidence? Thus, Brinda and Lalita were finally forced to enter into a scriptural debate with me and Madhu. Exhibiting learning in grammar and logic, each side presented their arguments. Ultimately, however, supported by Radhika from the Kadamba Kunja, Lalita Devi's point of view prevailed. The gopis laughed uproariously at my defeat. I stood disarmed by their super excellent intelligence, my pompous boasting silenced. At such a delicate moment, humiliated by the gopi's sharp wit, I had but one final strategy, the threat of superior strength. Taking a deep breath, I took a bold step forward. Raising my voice over the din of the gopis' laughter, I cried out, you wives of peasants, you have received cloth, jewels, and houses from my family, Braja's ruling class, intoxicated by adolescence. Do you now want to rule over your superiors? I'll teach you. Advancing towards the gopis, my hands raised in a menacing pose, a scowl on my face, I growled, I shall discipline you all and plunder your lips. But before I could touch even one retreating gopi, Lalita assailed me with a thunderclap of words. She yelled, stop, stop, you knave. Take another step and I shall inform your mother. Stop! I turned on Lalita and snapped back. When engaged in a dispute, villagers may argue to take help from a mediator, but kings settle disputes and acquire territory by the strength of their arms. If you are desirous of my kingdom, stand and fight. If you win the battle, then Vrindavan is yours. As I charged towards Lalita, all the other gopis fled, but Nandamukhi stepped between us. O hero, said Nandi, How can you wage war upon weak girls? And in my presence at that, please listen and keep your distance. Before Nandi could continue, Chandramukhi, standing in the middle of the clearing, interjected, Nandi is right. We are members of the fair and gentle sex. You may be strong and over-aggressive, but I know how to tame you in a flash. I stopped my advance, and the gopis halted their retreat. What was that? What was this young girl saying? Tame me? Chandramukhi chided. There, there. Don't take offense. But tell us, Hari, don't you become completely docile in the presence of Srimati Radharani? That may be true, but where is your Srimati now? I challenged. We will return home, she continued. Inform Radhika of these developments and request her to battle with you. The mere thought of contending with Radha calmed me. Chandramukhi took up a combat pose and played the role of a Radha archer. When she arrives here, standing at a distance, Radha will release the bow of her two arched eyebrows. When she arrives here, standing at a distance, Radha will release from her bow of her two arched eyebrows a volley of the sharpened arrows of her glance. Then you will tremble, falter, and cry like a trumpeting elephant. O Krishna, what recourse will you have other than to fall at Radha's lotus feet and offer her all your wealth? But fear not, our Radhika's heart is always melting with compassion. No doubt she will gracefully accept your surrender, and as a sign of your final conquest, she will place her lotus feet upon your head. Won't you look beautiful, your forehead decorated with the red lac of Radha's lotus feet? In that way, by her grace, you too may become her menial servant. I thrilled at the prospect of being the target of Radhika's arrow-like glances. But when Chandramukhi spoke of my becoming Radhika's menial servant, I almost fainted in ecstasy. What greater treasure is there than to attain the position of Radhika's Palya Dasi? What greater fortune is there than to serve Radhika's Manjaris? Captivated by Chandramukhi's words, I lost my forceful mood. As I looked towards Radha's holding place, I addressed Nandamukhi in a subdued voice. O Brahmani, although Radha may reprimand me, I cannot feel anything but affection for her. And how can I feel anything else for her friends? Let us assess the value of my pearls. Then, with as much gold, silver, dye, dancing, singing, ornaments, joking fun, divine emotions, loving sentiments, and with as many of their adorable cows as it is appropriate, these gopis can purchase those pearls. A moment of hopeful silence spread amongst the gopis. But then I thought to myself, this pastime has now come full circle. I have embarrassed the gopis as much as they have me. What purpose will this diversion serve? As I was looking at the beautiful faces of the gopis, I detected the fragrance of nearby Radha. There are better ways to show my love than selling pearls, I thought. Raising my hands in hopelessness, I said, and even if I do sell my pearls, then where will I safely keep the profit? That I do not know. And who can I trust to guard this wealth? That is also a mystery. The gopis appeared crestfallen. I looked towards the sun and added, I'm not a pearl salesman. On Purnamashi's order, I have tried to appease these gopis, and although two praharas have passed, still we have not reached an agreement. Now duty calls. I must take my cows to Govardhan Hill. Lalita Devi interrupted, O Nandi, these astonishing Vrindavan fields, their uncommon pearl seeds, these extraordinary pearl fruits, this remarkable pearl merchant, his unprecedented prices, all are from the realm of exotic wonder. Yet, we are common girls living everyday lives with ordinary household chores. We have very nominal means. Under such conflicting circumstances, how can we ever come to an agreement? Lita gazed at her flock of gopis and at Radha's Kunja. Considering that we were unable to come to an agreement, and considering that we too have household chores to perform, it is better that we gopis go home. The gopis followed Lalita, gathering their belongings, and collected Radha from the Kunj. With their princess in the lead, displaying ecstatic symptoms, they cast farewell glances at me as they turned to a bakula grove by the banks of the Radha Kund. Silence descended upon Yamuna after the departure of the gopis. I kept looking for a long time in the direction they had gone. Their loving arguments, playful gestures, and relentless scheming had delighted me. And just as this new pastime, with all its novel twists and turns, had left me exhilarated, and it had done the same for the gopis. With the help of my friends, I happily gathered together the scattered pearls. Selecting the very best ones, I fashioned a variety of exquisite ornaments for Radha. I placed these ornaments in a golden box and decorated it with auspicious letters of her name. Then I made ornaments for Lalita, Bishakha, and the others, placing them in individual boxes, each bearing the name of its recipient. In addition, I filled a large basket with unstrung pearls and charged Madhu Mangal, Subal, and Nandi with the blissful task of delivering the entire shipment to the gopis. When the gopis received these gifts of pearls and ornaments, they were overjoyed. They no longer felt threatened by the scepter of their husband's wrath. Completely satisfied, in a blissful state of mind, they rewarded Madhu Mangal with delicious foods and the others with fine scented oils and sandalwood paste. And as a token of love, they sent me freshly strung jasmine garlands and packets of camphor-scented tambula. The gopis' gifts were saturated with loving affection. Not only did I feel completely compensated for my pearls, I understood that the earlier bargaining session in love was the great profit I had made. Overall, I had received more than a fair payment. Sitting before the flower cottage, I decorated myself with the garlands and enjoyed tambula. Then, in the company of my friends, we set off to herd the cows by Govardhan Hill. Lalita decorated Radhika's transcendental body with a pearl headset, necklace, armlets, bracelets, and anklets I had sent. Radha thrilled at the touch of these ornaments. She considered that the fertile field of my love had grown them, and that her desire for my happiness had harvested them. When Lalita had finished, she raised a mirror before Radha, who marveled at her own beauty. This is only for Shyama, she thought. His desire for my pleasure and mine for his surely enhanced my matchless beauty. May he always be very happy. Bishakha and the other gopis then decorated one another happily, chatting about their mercantile skills. By defeating Krishna, we have purchased these pearls for a few flowers. Later, when they returned to their homes, the gopis presented many exquisite pearls to their husbands and elders, who were more than satisfied. By investing their family fortunes, the cowherd men had realized a handsome profit, and they glorified me as a prisoner of agricultural techniques. For days thereafter, the gopis and I would amuse ourselves by recalling the tournament of joking words we had exchanged in the pastime of the pearls. While strolling in the forest, we would reenact the arguments, gestures, and expressions we had used during the barter. In the rasa dance, we would sing wonderful songs describing the different scenes of this mukta charita and repeatedly taste the nectar of those pastimes. And of course, my dear friends, headed by Subal and Madhu Mangal, glorified me to no end for curbing, at least for the moment, the Braja Gopis' youthful arrogance. As we followed the cows through the pastures, the gopas fashioned many ornaments and many ornament-like jokes from the pearl pastimes and incessantly decorated their lips and ears with them. Jai Srimati Radha Rani Ki Jai. Shri Radha Astami Ki Jai. Nitai Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bo. So that was the pearl story.